It's certainly my pleasure to be with you this evening, this very serious time. As I was working on my remarks yesterday for this evening's program, I was interrupted by the sound of the air raid siren, warning me about an incoming attack. My children were at home. I called them to come downstairs. They didn't understand. They were in the middle of doing something. I said, it's very important. Come down, come down. We all ran down to the Mamad. I actually ran outside quickly. There were some people outside. We were inviting them into the Mamad when I heard a boom echoing through the valley as the rocket fell in a nearby neighborhood. If I need a reminder as to the seriousness of this time, certainly this was a good one. For us in the Yerushalayim Gush Etzion area, we of course only, Baruch Hashem, have had two of these and have avoided any direct hits. For our brothers and sisters in the South, life has been a daily series of these occurrences, of these warnings, times when they knew that their lives and the lives of their loved ones were put in jeopardy. Tonight's program, in support of our citizens, our fellow citizens in the South, is filled with Torah, with tefillah, and tzedakah. And what I want to do with you tonight is to provide some conceptual context for the ongoing battle with Hamas. We've reached the ceasefire agreement that was just announced, but we all know that the battle with Hamas has not come to an end. And what I want to do is put this in some context so we could better understand what it is that we're fighting and what we here can do, the people in this room, what we can do to help our cause. To get there, I want to begin with two stories about two separate conversations that I had with Arab Muslims that helped me understand the nature of this conflict. The conversations took place in Hebrew University. Rabbi Haber mentioned that I'm completing my doctorate, and as such, I am spend a lot of time in the halls and the libraries of Haaretz Ofim campus of Hebrew University. It's a very interesting campus because you have a mixture of Arab and Jewish students. And one of the fascinating things is how these students actually don't really talk to one another. They coexist, they walk in the halls, they study in the same rooms, but the Jews generally stick with the Jews and the Arabs with the Arabs. And when I have an opportunity, I actually like striking up conversations to understand a little bit about the other side. Maybe it's the pulpit rabbi within me to talk to and understand and relate to the people around me. So I remember one day I was walking in Hebrew University when I heard a roar in the forum. Have anybody here been in Haaretz Ofim? Do you know what the forum is? The forum. So the forum is the center. The center with the spokes of the university coming out. It's a center where everything sort of has to go through. And I heard this roar, the screaming in the forum. So I went to find out what it was about. And it turned out that day, I didn't know this at the time, was a day that the Arabs referred to as Nakba Day. It was the day of the, what they call the catastrophe. What happened is there was a group of Arab students, these are Hebrew University students, that were standing in the middle of the forum screaming, Israel is a fascist state, Israel is a fascist state. On the other side, there was a group of Jewish students, I think from, I forgot which organization, that was screaming, I don't remember exactly, no we're not. No, they were screaming, you know, Am Yisrael Chai. I don't remember what they were screaming. So I went to one of the Arab students who was protesting. I said, in English, that's my entree in, because I'm so clearly not Israeli, or, you know, born native Israeli. So I started speaking to him. I said, can you tell me what this is about? And he started explaining to me, you know, what's going on from his perspective. And we started engaging in a conversation, which to me was fascinating. I'm not going to go into all of it. There are many levels. The first thing I, of course, pointed out to him is, you know, you're screaming that Israel is a fascist state. You know, can you imagine if you were in Saudi Arabia right now and standing in one of their universities and you were screaming, Saudi Arabia is a fascist state? What exactly do you think would happen to you in such a situation? And we had a real conversation, and it was pointed at times, but always congenial, nothing heated. So I asked him, I said, what do you think about two states for two people? Are you for you know, the peace process? And he said, of course not. Of course I'm against the peace process. So why are you against the peace process? Now keep in mind, this is an Israeli citizen. He's a student of Hebrew University. He's an Israeli citizen benefiting from the state of Israel. He says, I'm against the peace process because you guys took our state, you took our lands, and then you're only giving us a piece of it. You know, you always ask us, how come you're not happy? But let's say you took my whole pie, you stole my pie, and then you gave me a piece of pie. Why would I be happy with a piece when I had the whole? And I said to him, that's really fascinating. When did the Palestinians have a state here? When did we take it from you? He said, before Israel, there was a Palestinian state. And I said, I'm pretty sure that before Israel, Britain was here. I'm pretty sure the British were in charge of them. He goes, yeah, but before that. He said, I'm pretty sure that before that, it was the Ottoman Empire. And they had it for a number of hundreds of years. And he's like, no, in between there was a Palestinian state. And what occurred to me is the tremendous disconnect between us. That we have a disconnect in our narratives, in our facts. I think it was a Senator Moynihan that said that you could have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. So here we have a situation where you have a people with their own facts, with their own history. And they raised on that history. And that's what this student thought, that there was a Palestinian state and we took it from them. That was my first sense of the tremendous divide. I'll tell you another story. So one day I noticed in the hall that there was an exhibit, there was a photo exhibit, which showed showed the old city from an Arab perspective. It was trying to educate the Hebrew University students, or Jewish students, to see the Eir Atika from an Arab perspective. And I was very struck by these pictures, because not only did they introduce me to places I never saw, because we only go into the Jewish quarter, but also the portrayal of the Israelis and the Jews as somewhat ominous and threatening. And right next to me was a young Arab woman, a student, Arab Muslim student, and I started talking to her. And I said, I introduced myself. I didn't know if, and sometimes the Arab, young Arab women don't like talking to other men. And so she was very comfortable, and we were speaking. And I said to her, is this how you see East Jerusalem? Is this how you see the Eretz Yisrael? Is this how you see the old city? And she said, absolutely. She says, absolutely. I'm afraid of the Jews. I'm afraid of the Israelis. I said, you're afraid of the Israelis? I'm afraid of the Arabs. She goes, why should you be afraid of the Arabs? You guys have guns. You walk around with weapons. We're not allowed to own weapons. I would never walk into the Jewish quarter. I'm scared to death of walking. I said, you're scared of the Jewish quarter? I would never walk into the Arab neighborhoods. And I tried to explain to her that we're actually the ones that have been getting attacked. And again, it showed me this tremendous disconnect, that not only do we have different histories and different narratives, we have different perspectives of reality. We view the same situation, in this case the old city, in fundamentally different ways. But then she said something else, which actually altered my whole perception of this conflict and gave me an insight into the true nature of Judaism. I asked her what she thought about Israelis. And she said to me, Israelis, I understand. They grew up here. They live here. They want to retain control. I understand them totally. What I don't understand is you. Why did you come here? You're living in America. Why would you move to Israel? Why all of a sudden have over 1 million Russian Jews move to Israel? Why did the Ethiopians come to Israel? Why are you all here? And this earnest question from my Muslim Arab interlocutor helped me realize why Judaism is so different and distinct from the other major religions, and why there's a fundamental disconnect between Jews and practitioners of other religions in regard to the question of Israel. Now, to understand this, we need to do a little background. A little background into the conceptual debate between Islam and Judaism as to how we perceive the state of Israel. And then I'll get back to my conversation with this Arab student. So let's start with Islam. How does Islam see Israel? Well, let's begin with a more essential question. How does Islam view the world? So we're all familiar with the term jihad. What does jihad mean? What does it mean? Holy war.
Holy war.
Holy war. Now this term is not an incidental term to Islam, but it's a very critical term for Islam. Take a look at the source sheets. If you look at source number one. Source number one is Bat Yor. He's a well-known scholar on Islam. Writes, the jihad is a global conception that divides the people of the world into two irreconcilable camps. That of Dar al-Harb, the territory of war, which covers those regions controlled by the infidels, non-Muslims, and the Dar al-Islam, the territory of Islam, the Muslim homeland where Islamic law reigns. The jihad is a normal and permanent state of war between the Muslims and the Dar al-Harb. A war that can only end with the final domination over unbelievers and the absolute supremacy of Israel throughout the of Islam. Sorry. That was not a Freudian slip in any way. The absolute supremacy of Islam throughout the world. Now, Bat Yor is actually a little bit extreme in her formulations. We'll just take it for now. She says that Islam is divided, divides the world into two parts. This is for sure true. There's the Dar al-Islam, which is the countries controlled by Muslims, and the Dar al-Harb, which is the rest of the world. And in Bat Yor's explanation, the Muslims divided into the world that's owned by us and the part of the world that will be owned by us. Those are the two divisions. In the 7th century, Islam was founded by Muhammad, and soon afterwards, the Muslims began to conquer lands. They spread from Arabia, through North Africa, into Europe, up to Spain. They were a dominant and powerful, powerful people. And all of these lands were placed under the Dar al-Islam. They were under Islamic rule. Now there's some question as to if Muslims need to really conquer the whole world, if that's part of their shita, if they fight in order to protect their lives as Muslims. It's a whole scholarly issue, which we don't have to go into, but there's no question that they were expansionist in their outlook from the beginning of their creation, from the beginning of their founding. Now, what's important for us to realize is the distinction between the Dar al-Harb and the Dar al-Islam, is that any lands that were once ruled, once under the Dar al-Islam, is Islam. And even if another nation conquers it afterwards, that means that the Muslims have to fight to retake that land back. Because that land is fundamentally their land. In 637, the Muslims conquered the Byzantines and took Jerusalem. And they took the land that we know as the land of Israel. This placed our land under the Dar al-Islam. And we know, of course, afterwards there was a back and forth with the First Crusade to 96 and onwards. But ever since 637, this land has been under the Dar al-Islam. Now, if you understand that, you can understand the Hamas Charter. If you look at source number two, the Covenant of the Islamic Resistance Movement. I started to read this to my wife, and she said, don't read this to me. This makes me too scared. So, listen to the Hamas covenant. The Islamic resistant movement believes that the land of Palestine is an Islamic waqif, consecrated for future Muslim generations until Judgment Day. It or any part of it should not be squandered. It or any part of it should not be given up. Neither a single Arab country nor all Arab countries, neither any king or president nor all the kings and presidents, neither any organization nor all of them, be they Palestinian or Arab, possess the right to do that. Palestine, an Israeli waqif land, consecrated for Muslim generations until Judgment Day. This being so, who could claim to have the right to represent Muslim generations till Judgment Day? This is the law governing the land of Palestine in the Islamic Sharia, and the same goes for any land the Muslims have conquered by force, because during the times of Islamic conquest, the Muslims consecrated these lands to Muslim generations till the Day of Judgment. 637, they took it. It's a Muslim land. It will always be a Muslim land, and therefore no Muslim, no person has the right to ever give up any part of this land. It is all Islamic land. And they have a quote in a different section: Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before. Okay? Often in the West, the conflict with even Hamas is seen through a political or territorial lens. The truth is, it's a religious conflict. Hamas understands that modern-day Israel is Dar al-Islam, and as such, it must be returned to the Muslims, and no one has the right to allow the Jews to retain control over the land. It's very clear. It's very black and white. They don't hide anything. It's their tocho kabaro. They tell you as they feel. They put it out. It's on the internet. Very clear what their shita is. That's what they feel. Now, you should notice with this position that Israel actually has no special place in Islam. It's not a holy place, Israel. Okay, it's just one of the lands under the Dar al-Islam. There are other lands too. It's not Dafka place, Israel, that all the Muslims need to live. It's just one place that's part of the Islamic world. But the whole world is open to them. They do have holy places, meaning they do think that Al-Quds, that the mosque, is a holy place. Why do they think the mosque is a holy place? Because later generations interpreted the language of the Quran, who says that Muhammad had a nighttime flight, that he went up to the heavens, and they interpreted it to be take place at that spot. So there is some holiness, they say, to that place. But there's no special place about Israel that Israel occupies in Islam. Contrast this to, obviously, Yadus, to the Jewish perspective. And from the Jewish perspective, let's just take source number 3, source number 4, which are the basic texts, the two covenants that Hashem made to Abraham. And we'll read this together quickly, and I'll ask you to compare and contrast them. Tell me what you think. The Brit Ben Abtarim, source number 3. I am the Lord that took you out of Ur Kasdim, God says to Abraham, to give to you this land to inherit. Turn the page. Next underline, Yud Chet. Bayomahu kareit Hashem et Avram brit le'mol lezarachan etati et ha'aretz hazot. God says to Abram, he splits the pieces of the animal, the pillar the cloud goes through, and what happens? God made a covenant with Abram that day, to your children I will give this land. That is the Brit Ben Abtarim, that's the promise. Let's look at God's promise in the Brit Milah, source number 4. God says to Abraham, do the Brit Milah, look at the underlines, Vakimoti et priti beni beinecha ben zarecha achrecha, I will establish my covenant between me and you and your children after you for future generations as an everlasting covenant to be to you for God. And I'll give to you and your descendants after you the land that you sojourn, the land of Canaan, as a permanent possession, and I'll be to you as a God. Tell me, what is the differences between these two covenants that God is promising? What are the differences in God's promise? Obviously, it's not the same promise. What do we have over here? What do you think? Say again?
One is like forever. He says that he'll continue. The first one is just him saying, I'll give it to you, Abraham. And he says to
your kids. Yafeh. One, in the Brit Milah, there's the extra achuzat olam. There's the foreverness that isn't... It's not spelled out, at least, in the Brit Ben Abtarim. Very nice. What are the differences between them? There are no wrong answers. Whatever you say, I'll make right. Don't worry. What else? What are the differences between them? I'm sorry?
One's like saying, right now I'll make the three, and one's saying, like, I will make
the brit. Yeah, very nice. That one is the brit milah is right now. Right? The brit milah takes place right now in a sense. Here, Hashem tells Abraham that this whole thing is going to take place when? You're going to go to your children, you go to Egypt. Well, they don't say Egypt, but to a country. It's going to oppress you. They're going to come out. And after the generations, you're going to get the land. Good. Okay, yafeh. Any other differences? Yes. Well, you could be saying a couple of things. There's a two-wayness of the Brit Milah in the sense that Avram has to do something. What does Avram have to do? He has to do the Milah. As in Brit Ben Abtarim, it's one way. It's God, you know, coming through the pieces in a sense. And Avram has nothing that he has to do. Okay? Any other differences? Yes. Oh, let me get somebody who didn't say anything yet. Yes.
Yeah,
fair.
The connection between us and the first one is nothing, what we have to do, nothing, no connection.
Exactly, and that's part of what you're saying about the two-way and the one-way. And I knew that's what you're saying also, I just wanted to get it fleshed out, which is that the first covenant is just about the land. It's God giving the land to Abraham's descendants. The second covenant adds another piece. It's not just about land, it's about God. In the Brit Ben Abtarim, your children will inherit the land. In the Brit Milah, it also mentions land. Your children will inherit the land, and I will be to them as an Elohim. So we have a new element. The first Brit is that Israel will be your national homeland. There's no mention of religion or God at all. Just that Avram's children will be a nation, and they'll inherit the land. The second covenant, which includes this action by Abraham, adds the religious component that Hashem will be their God. And this adds a different element, not just to the Brits, but I would suggest to what the land of Israel is. Because now it's not just home to Jews, but it's the home to Judaism. It's not just about the nation, it's about religion. Israel is a place for Jews, and it's a place for Judaism. For Jews, it's our national homeland. For Judaism, it's the place we express our religion and commitment to Hashem in the fullest way possible. It's the place of Kedusha, of sanctity, a place of Hashem. The first Brit sees Israel as a homeland. The second Brit sees Israel as a holy land. When we talk about Israel, we often think of it, what words do we think of when we think about Israel? It's the holy land. But that's only one component. It's the holy land, and it's a homeland. It's two totally different things. And these different things manifest itself in halakha as well. There's certain halakhot that only apply to Israel. What are some halakhot that only apply to Israel? Shemitah.
Maaser.
Korban. In the Beit HaMikdash. Challah. Yafeh. What else? Orla. Okay, what else? Tautological, yes, Yishuv Haaretz only applies. That's actually critical. I'm going to get back to that. Yishuv Haaretz. Say again. To build the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, good. What else? All the things that have to do with the Kohen. Okay. Anything else very quickly? And the Levi for... Somebody who's a little biased on the Levi front. Any other mitzvot? I'm sorry? Okay. Kviat zmanim, establishing the calendar. Appointing a king. Okay, we got a lot of them. Yeah. Trumot amasot. Okay. What else?
Yovel,
Shemitah, and Yovel. Yafeh. Okay, we're getting to the harder ones now. You already got a lot of them, including the hard ones. We're getting to the really picky and hard ones. Any others? Yes. Would kilayim only apply here? Actually, kilayim would go out, but it is a Mishnah. Okay, that's interesting. Mishnah and Kedushin. Okay, anything else?
All the mitzvot.
All the mitzvot. Very true, Ramban. All the mitzvot. Maybe I'll try to get back to that. It'll be a tough one. They still have relatives in America here. Okay. Egla Rufa? Egla Rufa is only in Israel. What's Egla Rufa? Egla Rufa is when somebody dies outside and the Zakenim have to come out and say that it wasn't us, that we didn't do anything, we didn't kill him, and it wasn't us. Okay? Ir Miklat. Okay, good. Ir Miklat. No, not Petach Hamor, right? That's also an Eber Yarden. Part of our question is going to be, what is Israel? Say again? Ir Anidachat is certainly only in Israel. Good, Yafeh.
The people in the land of Israel.
Okay, let me just add one other one, which is important, is smicha. It's only important for Rabbanim. Smicha can only take place in Israel. Okay, also leket, shicha, and peah. Okay, all these things are in Israel. These are a lot of mitzvot, a lot of different mitzvot. Now, Rav Moshe Salvechik, this is the Rav Salvechik's father, was mechadesh, that in all these mitzvot, you could divide it into two categories. Or maybe not all of them, but a lot of them you could divide into two categories. There are some mitzvot that emerge from the kedusha of the land, the sanctity of the land. And there are other mitzvot that emerge from the concept, from the chefza, the name, the shame, the status of Israel. What are some things that emerge from the sanctity of the land? What are the chovat hakarka? Trumot of Maisrot, Shemitah and Yovel. The land, either how we treat it or maybe even something in the land. Depends on your hashkafic perspective. There's something that is kadosh, there's something that's holy. But there are other mitzvot that has nothing to do with holiness. Egla Rufa, Smicha, appointing the king. We should add, when they came into Israel, there was an obligation to destroy Amalek. All of these things have nothing to do with the sanctity of the land, but it has to do with Israel. And the way I like to see this distinction or explain it, again, this is Rav Moshe Salvechik, quoted by the Rav, and also Rav Aaron Salvechik, halachically, but I'd like to suggest it splits along the lines of Israel as a holy land versus Israel as our homeland. As a holy land, the land is kadosh, the land is holy, and therefore the fruit is holy, and therefore we have to give some of it to Hashem, and therefore we have to let the land rest every 7 years, and therefore there's a concept of Yovel. That's Israel as a holy land. As our homeland, we need to appoint leaders, have smicha. We need to set the calendar. We need to set the calendar so that both in your private domain and in the public square, everyone is on the same page and enjoying the spirit of the season. You see now, living in Israel, the difference when the calendar is set according to the Jewish calendar and the public square is filled with Jewish symbols. That's part of being in our homeland. We need Egla Arufa. We need to be clear that we are responsible for our fellow Jews in our homeland. And maybe even some people suggest leket, shicha, and peah. We need to leave over portions that we need to care when it's our national homeland. We need to make sure that everyone is taken care of. Israel means two things to us. It's Israel is a holy land, and Israel is our national homeland. It's our national homeland. And this is an important point. Because it's important to realize that in both of those concepts, doesn't apply in Islam. Islam does not have this. It doesn't have this concept of holy land. For them, holy means something else. Meaning they have holy cities. What are the holy cities? Mecca, Medina, and Al-Quds. Why are these holy cities? Because of events of Muhammad's life. Muhammad was born in Mecca, and his ministry was in Medina, and Al-Quds was the place of his night visit or flight. Okay, they have holy land they don't have, but what they certainly don't have, and this is what I want to emphasize, is a homeland. They don't have a homeland. Not only is Israel not their homeland, there is no concept of a homeland. And it's not just in Israel, it's true in Christianity as well. These are universalistic religions. What does it mean that they're universalistic? That means?
It's anywhere.
It's in all places. Everyone's God's child. And you can become a Christian and a Muslim in a second. How do you become a Christian or a Muslim? You say the statement. You say one statement of their beliefs. You become a Christian and a Muslim. They're universalistic religions. There's no special place and there's no special people. It's about a belief. And you can move it quickly. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. Judaism, however, is also universalistic in the sense that there's one God over the entire world who cares about all of the inhabitants, all of humanity. Each member of humanity is God's child. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there are particularistic elements, like singling out one people to have special obligations so they can be a light unto the other nations, and separating out Israel to be their eternal homeland. But this concept does not exist in the other religions, and as such, I think it's not even understood by them. And this is the point that was brought home to me with my conversation with the Arab Muslim student. She says to me that I understand that Israelis who grew up here want to live here and keep control over the land. But what I don't understand is you. Why did you come here? You're living in America. Why would you move to Israel? Why are there a million Russians here? Why are the Ethiopians here? Why are all these people coming here? I don't understand. And when she said that, it occurred to me that there's no concept of kibbutz galiot in the other religions. There's no concept of the ingathering of the exiles. That wherever one is scattered throughout the course of history, that they will return back to their homeland. If you think about it, think what the Palestinians have to do to ensure that their quote-unquote exiles from just 1948 still remain attached to Palestine. What do they have to do to them? They have to keep them stuck in refugee camps, living in squalid conditions. They have to keep them penned in, because they know that if you let them out, what's going to happen? They're going to move to whatever country they move to, and they're going to acclimate to that country, and they'll lose their connection to Palestine. That's normal. That's the way the world works. If your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather lived in a certain country, and then they moved to another country, and generations, you were raised in this other country, you don't think about that country before is your country. That's normal. That's how people are. The native country that you're in is the one that you're a member of, not the one long forgotten in your past. It's only the Jews, with our sense of Israel as not just a holy land, but also an eternal homeland. It's only the Jews who say every year, wherever we are in the world, throughout our history, in the terrible times and the great times, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim habnuya, that next year will be in Jerusalem. It's only the Jews that after close to 2,000 years in exile, never gave up that hope that tikva liyot am chafshi ba'artzeinu, be'eretz Zion, Yerushalayim. Not only are we the only ones who feel this way about Israel, we're the only ones who feel this way about any place in the world. It's a concept that doesn't exist in the other religions. As such, there's a huge conceptual and psychological disconnect between us and Muslims, and really us and every other people. We don't just have a narrative disconnect, as we spoke about different views of history. We don't just have a perspective disconnect about the reality of today. But there's a profound conceptual and psychological disconnect. Where the very words we use, when we say one thing, we mean one thing, and they understand it in a totally different way. When we speak about Israel, to others, it seems like we're, you know, using words that everyone would understand. To other people, Israel is a country like any other country. To Muslims, it signals perhaps a catastrophe, as a land that was once Dar al-Islam, that was taken away from them. But for us, the world is the word Israel means Kedusha. It means sanctity. And it means home. It means home. This is a huge piece. Our history is different. Our perspectives are different. Our facts are different. But even the words that we use are different. There's a tremendous psychological disconnect between us and certainly the Muslims and really all other peoples in the world. So I want to suggest a prescription forward for how we can win this war. Not the military war or the political war. That I'll leave to the generals and the politicians. But how to win this conceptual war. And it's a war that I believe is not won by convincing the other side and explaining to them our position. Although respectful dialogue and mutual understanding is always a positive thing. But it's a battle that needs to be fought amongst ourselves. The famous Rashi, the first Rashi in Chumash, Rashi asks the question, why is it that we start the Torah with this whole narrative about creation and about Adam and about Noah and Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov and Mitzrayim? Why don't we just start the Torah with HaChodesh HaZelechem? The Torah is a book of mitzvot. So why don't we just learn the mitzvot? Why do we need to start with all these stories and starting with the creation of the world? And Rashi says, the reason why we need to, She'im yomru umot ha'olam li'Yisrael listim atem, that if the nations of the world say to the Jews, you are robbers, she'kavashtem arzot shivagayim, that you conquered this land from the seven Canaan nations. Heim omrim lahem, so the Jews can answer, Kol ha'aretz shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the land is God's. Hu bara v'natna l'Hashem yashar b'einav, he created and gives it to who he feels is right. B'tzono natna lahem, b'tzono natna lahem, natna lanu. In the beginning he gave it to them, then he felt it was right to take it away from them and give it to the Jews. The Rashi says that the reason for the whole beginning of the whole book of Bereshit is so that we have an answer to the nations of the world when they claim that we stole, that the land of Israel is not your land. That we stole the land. Now, of course, the obvious question is what? What's the obvious question? Is why would they believe us? Why would the nations of the world, you read this Rashi, I remember the first time, I don't know how old I was, and the obvious thing you think of is, why would the nations of the world care what's written in the beginning of Bereshit, and why would that prove anything to them? So what that you say that to them? How does that prove anything? Now, the truth is that one might point out that actually billions of non-Jews, billions, accept the veracity of the Old Testament and Genesis. So maybe this Rashi is not so peculiar after all, and maybe it could convince them. But perhaps even more simply, the stories in Bereshit are not meant to convince the non-Jews. They're meant to convince the Jews. For if the Jews believe this claim, that Israel was given to us as our homeland, and if the Jews stuck together, because we believe this claim, then we would have the strength and the fortitude to defend against any attack against our land, whether it's a martial attack, a political attack, or a conceptual attack. We can defend against any attack if we believe this and we stuck together. And in this regard of spreading the message of Israel as our eternal homeland, I think we in the Olim community, the Americans who live in Israel, and the Western Aliyah, not just the Americans, have a special role to play in this effort. You know, I came to Israel after a sabbatical. It's a long story. Mar Eileen could tell you about it maybe afterwards. That I came here on sabbatical from my, I was the rabbi of the Jewish Center community that I dearly, not just loved, but continued to love. And I took a sabbatical with the understanding, the communal understanding, that there was a chance that I might decide to stay. Yeah, wonderful, we worked out how to arrange it. I remember the reactions of people at the time. Some people said to me that that once you leave, we know you're never going to come back. Once you're in Israel, you're going to love it, you're going to stay. Other people said to me, you know, who knows? You know, there are opportunities there, opportunities here. I'd have no idea what you would do. Other people who met me during that year, who knew the story, thought for sure, without a doubt, that I'd go back to America and that I'd be crazy, crazy to stay in Israel. Who were those people who in the third camp? Israelis. To a man, they were Israelis. Israelis think we're nuts. They can't understand. They can't understand our aliyah. They understand the Russian aliyah. They understand the Ethiopian aliyah. These are not aliyot of choice. These are aliyot where you escape from something. But to actually run towards Israel doesn't make any sense. They're so used to reading and experiencing the problems and the challenges of living in Israel that they sometimes lose sight of the blessings. They lose sight that with all of their challenges, it's Israel which is our home, and Israel is the place in which we belong. And it's dafka the Western Aliyah that can remind them of how special it is to live in our homeland. Dafka because moving here came at some sacrifice of perhaps material or physical comforts and securities. Because moving here was not a matter of existential necessity, but a matter of choice, of bechirah chavshit, that our example can be a lesson and inspiration for Israelis. And I think it behooves all of us in the Olim community, to be a positive role model and convey that message through words and deeds to our Israeli neighbors, co-workers, and friends, that this is our home, this is where we choose to live, and this is where we belong. But of course, being an advocate for Israel as our homeland is not just for our fellow Jews within our borders, but to our brothers and sisters who live outside our borders as well. And this is also critical, especially in the time that we live in. I'll tell you a story. I remember one of my congregants would arrange these meetings with senators, very involved in lobbying, and apparently it's not so hard, it's not so expensive to get a senator to come and meet you. But they had a group of people who contributed, obviously let the rabbi come free, and we'd come and sit around and talk to the senator. I remember one time, the senator, I forgot from which state, and it's about Israel. The whole thing is about Israel. It's a pro-Israel advocacy, and the room and the conversation, you have an opportunity to say one thing, and not everybody, like maybe five people. There's a room of 20 people. Maybe you could, you know, could be you'll say something. Maybe you don't say anything. Right, it's very regimented, very short, very serious schedule. Anyway, so I raised my hand, and even though I was an unpaying member, because I was the rabbi, they allowed me to speak. And I said, I want to point out, I think it's very important to note that today is Yom Yerushalayim. Today is Yom Yerushalayim. It's the day of the unification of Jerusalem. And I just want to point out how wonderful and important it is that we have Jerusalem under Jewish control in our land. Next guy raises his hand and says, I want to disagree with the rabbi. He has one thing he could possibly say, one thing to the senator. And he chose to say that I disagree with the rabbi. It's because we took Jerusalem that we now have all these problems. We don't know what to do. We don't do the land. We have to split it and we have to give it back. And he went through this whole thing. And he turns to the senator and he said, Senator, what do you think? Now you have to understand, the senator came here to learn what he should be thinking. And he turned to us, he's like, what do you think? And it just showed me how we shoot ourselves in the foot so much. How we kill ourselves. One thing you could say, okay, you have different, this is what you have to tell him? How we shoot ourselves in the foot over and over again. Over and over again, how important it is for us as Olim to model in words and deeds our belief that Israel is our eternal homeland. And we should do so not just by encouraging Aliyah, but also by encouraging Aliyah. But I'm speaking something in a broader sense. It's about a mentality. It's about a mentality. Even if one happens to reside outside of Israel and is still will remain outside of Israel, having a mentality that Israel is our eternal homeland is critical for the Jewish future. In today's day and age, when the Jewish people are so divided, in today's day and age, when the economy is sputtering along and belt-tightening measures are the calls of the day, both for corporate and for not-for-profit world, in today's day and age, where the world of assimilation is rising, and apathy, if not antagonism, towards Israel by a younger generation of diaspora Jews is on the rise, the question of where Israel sits and the priorities of the diaspora Jewish community is a real and live conversation. Where one decides to direct his or her resources, and I mean all of one's resources, time, energy, skills, along with one's philanthropic contributions, is a real question. And it's not a yes or no question. There's no one right answer. It's percentages and proportions. And of course, there are issues in Chutz La'aretz that need to be addressed. But the question is where Israel is on the list of priorities. The more we successfully convey this message, the more we retain and transmit the message that Israel is our true homeland, the higher Israel will remain on the list of priorities, the greater chance will we have of responding to any threat against Israel with complete solidarity and strength. It's up to all of us. It's something that we can do. It's a positive step that we can do. We can do with this war against Hamas. The war against Hamas, what should we do? We should circle our wagons and make sure we're all on the same page, that we're standing strong together. Because if we are standing strong together, then nothing will defeat us. We might never be able to convince our enemies like Hamas that Israel is a true homeland of the Jewish people. But you know what? We can influence our fellow Jews. And it's by standing strong together that we can convey the message to those who threaten us and attack us. That whatever is thrown at us, Qassams, Katyushas, Fives or Fives, that we are not going away. More than that, we now have an army. And we will fight back. And we will win. The Jewish people, after close to 2,000 years, have returned back to our homeland. We have returned home. And this time, Bezrat Hashem, we are here to stay.